Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in since they going back to showing Action Tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the Anime Action Fan Sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative, right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your primetime host, Thomas Primetime Mattis, and I welcome you to episode 67 of The Prerogative. This week, by request, and when I say by request, I mean he'll hunt me down and hurt me if I don't review this, since I reviewed the first two entries in the series, we are going back to the world of black technology and the whispers and schools getting blown up by military otaku. Yes, I am, of course, talking about the world of Full Metal Panic per request of our good friend Gene. Like I said, told me that he will brutally hunt me down and murder me. I mean, that it would be in my best business, or best interest, I should say, to review Full Metal Panic Second Rate, because that's what's best for business. I'm not saying that Gene's a power-hungry maniac like Triple H, just that he made a suggestion that this was best for business. Oh, look, it's Daniel Bryan. Anyways, we're covering Full Metal Panic Second Raid. Brought to my attention that the English dub was on Hulu, which sometimes is not they. But I'm very glad, because it did allow me to finish the series, which is a very good series, and this is going to be an interesting... I'm not going to give away the secret of whether I like it or not. But yeah, very interesting to watch this. I've seen this series, so to go back and to finish the Full Metal Panic series with Full Metal Panic Second Raid, where we continue to follow the adventures of Sosuke Sagara, Ikenami Chidori, and the rest of the organization known as Mithril. It's definitely one of the things where I'm glad to sort of finish a bookend of a series. Even if we had to take a sort of short detour through two episodes to get there. Mind you, though, we really did go through three series. I mean, we did Full Metal Panic, we did Burn Up W, though we haven't covered Scrambled. That's because it's hard to find. I don't have the DVD, and I've not seen it on Hulu. I'm sure Gene somehow will throw on Twitter how wrong I am again on that one. Somehow he'll find it. We covered Tenchi Muyo GXP, which, again, just leans us down that road of covering the Tenchi OVAs and Tenchi Universe, which we will get to. and in the very near future. But like I said, this week it is Full Metal Panic, the second raid. This is definitely a very different feel from the first two. You know, this is definitely more of a focus on the drama. The comedy's there, with no doubt. There's definitely one or two filler episodes, but that's it, because again, this is another 13-episode series. There's more focus on the drama. There's more of a singular story that the focus is on. I mean, mind you, there's moments of comedy, and we're going to talk about it. There's one moment, and God, I hope I remember, because it's actually one of my favorite scenes in all of anime. Just because I want that screenshot. And right now somewhere, Gene is shivering like, no, not that. Don't worry, it's not that. It has nothing to do with fan service, actually. I know, a favorite scene of mine that I want a screenshot has nothing to do with fan service. Gosh, what a shock. We must listen to this episode more to find out what the hell it is. But definitely a different feel from the more balanced approach that the first season was in Full Metal Panic. And the complete opposite feel of the comedy-based season that FOMOFO was. But, you know, that we're going to save all that for the review, because there's so much to talk about with that. Before we get into the review, I'd like to remind you that, of course, I am celebrating my 5th year of being a podcaster on the interwebs. Which I'm so happy for. This month I'm celebrating 28th birthday, 5 years being a podcaster, 20 years being an anime fan, and of course I am throwing a big bash that you, the listener, are invited to on September 29th at 8 o'clock, Eastern Standard Time, Eastern America Standard Time, that is. And if you want to join the party, because we're going to be having a live call-in show where you listener can call in and talk with me and my guests, and we'll have some fun. We'll talk about some anime and everything like that. If you want to join in on the fun, you can do it by making sure that on September 29th, search for the name. We're going to be doing all of this on Skype. So go on Skype and search for the name Mattis Leonhardt. Friend me, and or basically say that you want to join in on the celebration. I'll friend you and I'll add you into the green room, and we'll bring you in one by one. As I've seen this, or my experience of seeing this done, one by one from the green room, and bring you on the show, and we'll talk and we'll have some fun. We'll record it and we'll have a good show to put on the webs, and it'll be hopefully tons of fun. Hopefully, if people come out. The hopeful part is right there. Anyways, that's on September 29th. Again, that's going to happen September 29th. Remember, go on Skype, find Mattis Leonhardt. That's L-E-O-N-H-A-R-T. And, on September 29th, and join in on the fun. With that, let's get right into our review of Full Metal Panic, the second rating. We'll start with our synopsis. This series takes place about 3 months after the events on the Truth to Denanin at the end of the original series. Mithril has become aware of a secret organization that has the technology, hit the Bionic Man music, able to counter their ECS system, or Electronic Cloaking System. This organization, known as Amalgam, also has the black technology obtained from their own whispers, or whispered, like Konami Chittery. And like other intelligent agencies, they intend to obtain more. However, when Sasuke's mission to protect Chittery is terminated by Mithril, all seems to be in place for Amalgam's plans. This is Full Metal Panic, the second raid. Frontier, 扉開いたら I really enjoyed the music all around for this series. Definitely different feels all around for the music. Probably the one exception being the ending music, which was very... It was, again, it was another sort of very serious, slow, sort of dramatic song, very much like from the first series. So that was very similar. And mind you, the music for the most part is similar. There are some touches and tones here that are very similar. But really, in the most part, the music is... I mean, that very sort of A-team-centric score, military theme, for the most part, isn't there anymore. They really started fresh and started new as far as military themes for Mithril and everything. And the opening theme is very different. And I think that's where we'll start, is the opening theme. A much more melancholy type of theme, you know, whereas in the original series you had Tomorrow that was very hopeful in its message and in its melody. Again, that whole 18 feel within its music as well, sort of the you felt the champions within the music. That was very much the original series, the love song that was Famofo. Here you have a much more serious, much more of a melancholy type of song in As the Wind Blows. And I believe I'm getting it right as I look up at my notes. Where are your notes? Up there. South Wind. And not As the Wind Blows, but South Wind is the name of the song, done by Mikuni Shimokawa. But yeah, it's much more melancholy, and it fits. It fits sort of this theme of Mithril. It's just that it's this very melancholy sort of military feel, as opposed to the more hopeful military feel of Tomorrow. So again, there's a vast difference. Again, both of these are sort of J-pop songs, but they're different tones, and they very much match the tones that you would feel in the series. And then you have the music in the series. Again, a different military theme. Not as catchy and just cheerful as... we have monsters in the house, ladies and gentlemen. but not as cheerful as sort of the military theme that from the original series. Again, and that's something... really themes of melancholy as far as a lot more drama and depression are within the music. Because again, there's a large portion of that, especially with the large part of the focus of the series being on Sosuke and sort of his depression of him trying to figure out what he is supposed to do and sort of the stress that he is feeling. Because of that, there's a lot more drama, and this is really implemented in a lot more use of strings. If you listen to the two series, the music in the series, back-to-back for the original Full Metal Panic and this one, there was a fair number of use of strings, but there was a lot more brass you'd probably hear in the pieces of the soundtrack for Full Metal Panic. Here, there's not as much brass. There's a lot more use of strings and winds when you listen to the individual pieces. And again, it's not to sit here and say that that's bad, because it's not. It fits what the series is trying to go for as far as themes and the mood that it wants the music to betray. And there's some very good themes that work extremely well with the animation that's put on the screen. Again, I enjoyed the very different military theme for what it is. It was catchy in its own way, just not as catchy, as I've stated before. But there's really the two pieces that really jump out to mind. And there were good pieces all over. There's some good comedy pieces and everything. Some really good sort of soft sort of romantic music. And a lot of the good key moments romantically that were not like life-threatening for Konami and for Sosuke. But again, it does come to the more dramatic moments here. I think of the music used while Sosuke was in Hong Kong. The music that surrounded him throughout those three episodes, just, you felt the weight that was on Sosuke at that moment. And then just, as he just wandered trying to figure out, what do I do? The music there was really well done. Especially for a sequel, for a Gonzo series, the music was extremely well done. But probably my favorite piece in the entire soundtrack is the piece, I call it the Konami horror piece, and I call it that. It's the piece of music that is playing, I want to say it's episode 11, or it could be 10, I can't remember off the top of my head, but basically, well, actually, it's not. It could be no. I don't want to go look it up. In other words, but basically, it's the piece where Sosuke's gone, and Konami passes by. I believe it's Zhong Yun Lan, who's been sent to go after, and she passes him, or she passes Konami, and she just immediately feels the shivers, and she immediately goes home. And she's searching her apartment, and for that, in the next episode, she's trying to find out who is watching her. The music has that, just that soft, that heavy percussion, that boom, boom, boom. And you're waiting for the jump scare. That scare, in a horror movie where, everything's in calm, and the stress has been amped up to 11, and they search, and nothing happens, nothing happens, nothing happens, and then boom, out of the blue, just when you think it's safe, monster comes out, kills the beautiful big-breasted girl. Not that I hate that or anything, no. Anyway, it always comes back to big-breasted girls. always does. I do that just to get on people's nerves. I really, because it's fun. Anyways, but no, the jump scare, and you think, oh my god, Yun Jean is gonna jump out of here, here's where she's going to attack, and just the music just does a wonderful job of just building that mood, and just ratcheting up the tension more and more and more, and you're just waiting for, you're waiting for the jump, you're waiting for the attack, you know something's about to happen, and you just keep waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, and they do a great job, and you think it's, Wrath is the final part, and the music's not there anymore, and that's when he gets hit, and that's when, Zhong starts attacking Kara, and it's done perfectly. It sets the mood. It perfectly exemplifies the tension that's going on in Chidori's life. It's really the first moment where she doesn't have Sosuke to protect her, and kind of finding out that everything he's been doing kind of been important. yeah. But no, it's just, it's done extremely well, and I very much enjoy it. With that, let's move on to animation. And the overall art style, again, it's very much the similar art style that Fullmetal Panic has always been in. Again, it's the same. It's Gonzo. It's, you know, same artists, same mini artists, same animator, same director working on this. I do believe it is. Probably wrong in there, but again, I'm not gonna go do the research because I'm lazy like that. Again, it's that thing of they've worked on it before, so obviously the improvements of being able to continuously work on the project and being able to make your craft better are there. So it captures everything that I feel was important as part of the Fullmetal Panic style within the overall art style. The character designs, again, improved. One thing I noticed that I found very interesting is, unlike Fullmetal Panic Mofu, where there was more sort of a bit more of a sketchy aspect to sort of fit that sort of cartoony feel to the more of the comedy styles of Mofu, definitely more bolder lines here, much more shadow in the faces and in sort of the designs, and definitely more of a serious approach to the designs overall. The returning characters done extremely well, and the new characters look at Gates is just a freaky little motherfucker. He just is. He scares the hell out of me. That's the type of character that, you know, you have nightmares about. Now, Goron, and we're going to get to Goron, you know, he gives you nightmares as well, but he's not the type of person that you have nightmares because you saw him. He's the type of person that, because of his actions and the way he acts normal about it, gives you nightmares. Gates is just a freaky looking motherfucker. He just is. And then Zhonglan and Xingyu Fan. The twins, again, very unique. Again, fitting their sort of character story, you know, the almost lifelessness that's sort of in their eyes. Especially being that they're kids. So I love that aspect of design. Leonard Testarossa. I love that there's these similarities where you can look at him like, okay, he's related to Tessa. It's that thing to where there's enough different that where he feels different, but there's enough of the same to where you can tell that they're related. So I love that aspect of the character designs. Then we have the mech designs. And mech designs were something I didn't talk about on, you know, Full Metal Panic review. And I hate that I didn't. I'm going to use this time now to talk about them all, because the mech designs in Fullmetal Panic are just absolutely incredible. I did a list long ago, and I'm bringing it up now, but I basically did a list where, back when I did my video versions of Tom's Prerogative, back when I called it Thomas's Prerogative. But I did a list of, like, the top 20 mechs, as far as I'm concerned. And I had ARX-7 Arbalest, which Sasuke pilots, as my number 2 top mech. I also had Venom as number 7. And I know I had the M9 as number 11 on the list. I say that because the mech designs are incredible. The Arbalest, like I said, number 2. It's just a very solid design. I love the color scheme as part of it. Of course, the character pilot is an important part of that. But it's definitely something to wear. Again, just a solid design. a very heroic look to it. You can see on a technical level how it would work, and it seems like this could actually work in the real world. The design aspects of it are incredible. Venom is just a wonderful looking sort of villain type of mech, with sort of the strands of hair up top and everything, and the more angular feel to it, again giving it that more villainous look of the mech design. The Venom mech suit is just incredible, and the M9s and all the other, the Savages, and sort of way they're almost pudgy, yet that leads to their sort of defense. I love that aspect of it. Along with all the other different mechs that are used throughout the series, the M9s are incredible. I love their design. Oh my god, I go gaga about the mech designs in this series. Both for Second Raid and for the original Full Metal Panic. They're just incredible. They definitely carry over mech designs, without a doubt, from the original Full Metal Panic. They add some new ones that are just incredible. But just solid mech design. I can't say enough about the Arbalest design and how great of a mech it looks. The only mech that I think is better than the Arbalest in my mind is Wing Zero. And for me to put it up there with Wing Zero and my favorite Gundams and everything. Which, by the way, when I did my mech month, that was something like, I tried to put a limit on Gundams I could put in there. Because I could have easily did the top 5 all Gundam. I really could. And I really wanted to use that whole Thomas's top 5. Actually, it wasn't for Thomas's part. Yeah, that's right. It was for Thomas's top 5. I almost forgot about that. But yeah, I wanted to sort of talk about other mechs that maybe don't get talked about in there. For that reason, I had like Liger Zero and other sort of maybe not well-known mechs in there. But like I said, mech designs just absolutely incredible. The action sequences are wonderful. Both mech battles and sort of hand-to-hand combat. Extremely well done. The gunfights are gorgeous. Very much out of a summer blockbuster movie. And again, I'm thinking now of my favorite scene because it involves some explosions. The mech battles are incredible. If there's one thing I have to say, though, about the hand-to-hand combat, and it's not that it wasn't bloody in the original series, I guess it's just, at some point, the violence is just a bit over the top for me. I guess really the scene I think of is, I want to say it's the third or the fourth episode. But when they're in the tunnels, and the team is rescuing the hostages, and of course one of the hostages is, I believe it's Zhang Yolan, who then, like, slits his neck. And it just, the deepness of the cut, and just how deep they show it before they show blood, and it's just, it's very disturbing. I guess it fits with the more serious mood of the series, but yeah, it's just disturbing. It kind of is. But outside of maybe really, it really is just that one scene where I just think they went too far. But outside of that, I think they did extremely well with the action scenes. They were incredible. From a technical level, I could follow everything that went on. More importantly, from a technical level, it seems like something that could happen in real life. Even though, again, we're also talking about mechs battling here. They seemed like I could walk outside and see those on the street tomorrow if somehow a armed slave battle broke out on my street. But yeah, it's just, they did an incredible job of building towards that. The action sequences were just, they built off of each other and were extremely well done. And then you have the background special effects, and no more needs to be said. The special effects are incredible, really well done with dust and rain effects and everything, and the use of shadows, even on the CG aspects of the show, like the truth that they've done on and other sort of more huge vehicles like that. And the backgrounds are incredible. Again, a wide variety of different locations that they go to, from the an island jungle to a Tokyo high school, the streets of Tokyo, the streets of Hong Kong, far eastern country. I know I'm like missing something. More inland city of China, that's the one I'm missing of, and like being in the tunnels and more urban environment. There's definitely more urban than there is in the sense of that Full Metal Panic, I think maybe had a bit more wider variety, because you did have urban in there, but you also had like Siberian snow forests. Forests of China, you had the desert, you had the island jungle, you had underwater battle. While Full Metal Panic maybe has a bit more, there is that good variety of different locations that Full Metal Panic, the second read, really touches on and does very, very well. So the background and special effects are done extremely well. With that, it is time for us to take a break and pay some imaginary bills as I pimp my friends. So we're going to take a break. I'm going to play a couple of promos for some other podcasts for you. And when we come back, we're going to get into acting and into story.
Hey everyone, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
Wait. I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986
and Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air. Eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from Crisis to Crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
Gathered together from the far reaches of the internet, are assembled a network of podcasts dedicated to the first and greatest superhero, Superman. The Superman Podcast Network is dedicated to covering all aspects of the Superman legend, featuring
The Thrilling Adventures of Superman,
Golden Age Superman,
the Superman Fan Podcast.
Superman in the Bronze Age.
From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
The Schuster Herald Podcast.
It's Superman.
The Carazerald Podcast.
The Arm of Pure Steel. A John Henry Allen Podcast.
The World's Best Podcast.
And Radio Kale from SupermanHomepage.com.
Join hosts
Michael Bradley,
John Wilson,
Billy Hogan,
Charlie Niemeyer,
J. David Weider,
Jeffrey Taylor,
Michael Bailey,
Scott Gardner,
Sam Rizzo,
Danny Sapp,
Matthew Epps,
I'm Isaac,
I'm Adam,
Dave Yunus, and co-host Scotty V.
at SupermanPodcastNetwork.com.
Ready to form Voltron!
This is a job for Superman.
Power Rangers!
Right away, Michael.
Autobots, transform!
By the power of Grayskull!
For the honor of Grayskull!
Hello. I'm the Doctor.
Charlie's Geekcast, coming January 1st, 2013, to www.charliesgeekcast.com.
And welcome back, and let's get right into it. And of course, let's go over our cast list first, as we go into acting first. We have Chris Patton as Sosuke Sagara, Lucy Christian as Konami Chitteri, Allison Keith as Melissa Mao, Vic Mignogna as Kurt Weber, Hilary Hagg as Tessa Tessarosa, Andy McCaven as Richard Mardukas, Blake Shepard as Leonard Tessarosa, Christine Atutin as Jean-Yu Fan, Kira Vincent Davis as Jean-Yu Lan, John Swayze as Gates, Greg Ayers as Shinji Kazama, James Reed Faulkner as Balfagan Klasso, Mike Kleinhertz as Andre Conan, Mike McGraw as Garin, Monica Rial is Keiko Tokiwa, and rounding it out, Chris Ayers as Ralph. And I just kind of focused on the sort of main cast there. Oh, and Andy McCavin is also Al, Sosuke's AI in The Obelisk. With acting, again, it's an ADV dub. They do an absolute terrific job. First and foremost, Chris Patton and Lucy Christian as Sosuke and Konami are the stars of the show. The focus is on them. They step up to the plate once again, as they always do, and they nail it out of the park. Just great chemistry between them. Even if, you know, for the most part, because those who know how they don't do it in a similar room. Those who know how they do dubbing, they come in on their own days and they dub their own parts. Even so, they had great chemistry together as far as being able to, because as you know, for those who know how they do it, they do sometimes listen to the other person's work to bounce off, and they'll sometimes leave something for the other actor if they're like a couple or something. So definitely, I'm sure that Chris and Lucy were leaving each other important notes of this is what I was going for, and along with the director throwing his thing in. You really felt great chemistry between the two characters from the voice work, which was very well done. The rest of the sort of protagonist cast did just an incredible job. Hilary Hagg really doing a great job of evolving the character of Tessa more in this series from, you know, because you had a very limited time with her in Full Metal Panic. And she had growth there, too. She was much more of a comedic character in the two episodes she sort of appears in FOMOFO. Here, there's definitely more of a focus, and definitely she's giving room to evolve into more of a steadfast and confident commander among the Mithril organization. And Hilary Hack does a great job in portraying that. Andy McCaven as Richard Mardukas had some very wonderful scenes. And then, of course, Allison Keith and Vic Mignogna as Melissa Mao and Kurt Schwever just do terrific job as sort of the comedy relief, but not quite the comedy. They're important enough where to call them comedy relief would sort of be insult, but they do provide the comedy, but they just do a wonderful job in this series. The different sort of emotions and different sort of sides of Melissa that Allison Keith brings out is just absolutely incredible. And Vic Mignogna is just Kurtz. It's one of those characters that, you know, Vic just owns. And then, of course, you have Monica Rial and Greg Ayers as Keiko and Shinji. Their limited time, again, do a great job sort of as the straight man to the comedy duo that is Sosuke and Konami. So, in that, they do a great job. Then you have our very varied list of antagonists. Here, I'm going to start off with Wrath. Because he's not quite a villain. I don't know where to put him, because he's a protagonist by the end. He's obviously part of Mithril. But for the most part, he is very much an antagonist to the wants of both Sasuke and Konami. Chris Ayers does a wonderful job of portraying that type of character that, to an extent, he's a roadblock in the way of them accomplishing something they want, but he's not necessarily the bad guy. It's that sort of classic, well, here's the person who's in my way. He's not necessarily a bad guy. He's doing his job, but he just, unfortunately, is a roadblock in my path. So he does a great job of that. And I've been trying to find who does the female voice at the end. I haven't been able to. But then you have Kira Vincent Davis and Christina Alton as the sisters, Fawn and Lon. Just the monotone aspect that they both put into their voices. They pretty much gave away, if you knew the series, who their sensei was within a couple episodes. And just through their voice. And the thing about it is, as they appeared more and more, and they did more and more, and you knew something was coming with Garen, who you pretty much guess within a couple episodes that's who it is, considering their focus on Sosuke. It really led towards that build-up. And it was this thing of where they're villains, and they're doing these horrible and just brutal things, and yet you can't help but feel sorry for them. They did a great job of portraying that into the characters. I think then you'll have Blake Shepherd, who really only has a few lines. There's only a few moments where Leonard talks. But, you know, again, it's Blake Shepherd, but he does a good job in putting those few lines as that person behind the scenes. Next time. It's definitely Blake Shepherd. It's not to say it's bad. Because it's not bad by any means. He accomplishes everything they needed for the character to be. I think it's just that there's not much of him. He has a few lines. But he's definitely an antagonist. He's just mostly silent through the series. So I don't know if I can have a sort of full feel to what his character is for the most part about, other than being the whispered for Amalgam. Then we have Gates. As I said before, Gates is a freaky motherfucker. That being said, just the crazy whacked out, you know, he, for the most part, he's trying to have Gates is trying to fulfill the role that Gorin was, as in the crazy nut job psychopath. But John Swayze just amps that up to 11 and just makes it perverted. It's just crazy. And it's this thing of, and to an extent, it's kind of brilliant how they do it, to where Gates never feels like a threat. He is crazy. He is a psychopath. And in a sense, he is definitely deadly, but he never feels dangerous. And it's just, you're waiting for him to get his comeuppance. And it just, the more crazy John Swayze acts as Gates throughout the series, the more you want to see him get his comeuppance. And so, in that sense, John Swayze did just an absolute incredible job. John Swayze is probably one of the more underrated actors during this time over at ADV. Still very much an underrated actor with Funimation and Sentai Filmworks. And last but not least, we have Mike Morrow as Gorin. And he only has one scene. But again, this is something to where it's built off his past scenes from the first series. But even more so, this one scene, he owns that scene. It's in this sense that I could not feel like, again, I made mention, it reminds me of sort of the vibes I felt listening to Heath Ledger's Joker. I almost forgot the name there for a second. But it's that same thing, and it's just, like, he almost won, and just the way he was just antagonizing Sosuke, and just the way he was just into it. He was all in with the character, and it was just an incredible scene of villainy. I loved it. It just, and again, we're going to be talking more about the story aspect about this in a second. But it's just, he owned that scene, and it's just him being the villain behind the scenes who's really caused all the chaos in this series. You think it's Amalgam. You think it's Gates. But in the end, the twist of it being Gorin from his deathbed, or what turns out to definitely be his deathbed, and just how everything was part of his plan, even when he couldn't physically do anything to cause that plan. It's just a thing of beauty, and really cements him as probably one of the best villains in all of anime. And part of that is just the performance of Mike McRow as Gorin. He just owns that character. He owned that scene. And in just one scene, and that's the thing, in one scene, he is a more dangerous character than Gates just off the voice. And it's just, it's incredible. And with that, perfect segue to go into story. And the first point we're going to talk about was story, which was, you know, definitely the fact that this is more of a focus on Sosuke with the plot. Because really, the crust of this series is Sosuke's depression, Sosuke's stress, you know, his loss of focus, his inability to pilot the Arbalest, or at the very least, his inability to activate the Lambda Driver. And how, you know, his detestment of the Arbalest, of being forced with a machine that he feels is a piece of junk, because why would you pilot any, you know, machine that can't activate its best weapon? A weapon that is, you know, built on emotions, which, again, to his extent, are useless to him. Or at least that's what he feels. And again, we see those emotions come out and him able to pilot it by the end. But definitely more of the focus and just that build-up of stress. And, you know, you definitely feel the weight of the world on his shoulders as a character. And again, just that going to that scene between him and Goran, everything leading up to that, and him being almost able to turn Sosuke, was just great. The buildup of him not, the frustration of not being able to bring out the full potential of Barbalisk, him being taken off his mission of guarding Konami, which he cares immensely about, because of intelligence. You see the stress built through the series, and its ultimate culmination of his story really starts with that meeting with Goran. And Goran basically goading him into killing her. Killing him. It just, the vibes of Batman and Joker from The Dark Knight, you can see the similarities. The scene itself was very much like that scene at the end of Dark Knight, where Heath Ledger basically tells Batman, you know, you think that this was all about a couple of lives on a boat? No. In other words, basically, that this wasn't about a fist fight with Batman. This was about getting Batman to cross the line, because Batman was the one pure element of Gotham that Joker could not corrupt, because that's the best Batman and Joker stories, are the stories where the Joker is trying to corrupt Batman, because the Joker, when done best, is the type of character that might kill, I'm quoting the almighty Michael Bailey here, in a joke that I take way too far all the time. But to quote him from from Bat Week, you know, the Joker is that is a character that, when done best, is the type of character that might kill you because he doesn't like your tie, but he also might not kill you because he likes your tie. Therefore, leading to the fact that the best Batman, Joker, and Batman stories are the type where the Joker is trying to basically corrupt Batman. And here it's no different. The reason I bring it up, because the parallel and the similar to that type of story, where the whole aspect of the villain is not to beat the hero in a fist fight, but to corrupt him. To, you know, again, Goran knows he's dying. He doesn't fear death, though. But he sees his lingering life as yet one last opportunity to corrupt Sosuke. And basically, having the twins do everything, basically leading up to Sosuke being in Hong Kong and coming to meet with him. And basically him lying to Sosuke, says that he had Konami killed. You know, it was all over the newspaper. She was nothing but, you know, bloody pieces. Her last words were sorry. You know, him continuously basically goading Sosuke into killing him. Because that was the final step. Because the whole point was to corrupt Sosuke, that he would basically become the next Goran. You know, Sosuke was, to an extent, his protege. And to corrupt him and sort of that pure heart that Sosuke had into, you know, killing him and not caring and just being a mercenary for hire and being the madness that Goran was. You know, that was Goran's plan. Goran was basically sacrificing his life to turn Sosuke into him. And it would have almost worked if for what is a perfect segue into our next point, and that is Konami. This series, one thing the series does as well, and does just as great as showing the stress and the ultimate culmination of sort of Sosuke's character, is sort of the relationship between Konami and Sosuke. And again, just some really great sort of romantic moments throughout the series. And then you have the moment to where Sosuke's gone and Konami realizes she needs him. It's like that really, that first acclimation in the series that she just absolutely needs Sosuke. Again, the whole build-up and the tension to where, you know, she's realized it, but he's nowhere. So she needs to take steps in her own hands. And she's basically recalling all the lessons that Sosuke has taught her to entrap Wraith and to survive against Fawn and to do all she can to find out information. And then her ultimate appearance in the final episode, which is... You know what? It was brilliant to play it from a comedic aspect. Like, Sosuke's all serious. There's all this drama and everything. All of a sudden, Konami appears. And she just starts beating the shit out of Sosuke. It's just brilliant. It was brilliant to do it in that comedy aspect. It really lightened the mood and really allowed yourself to understand, you know, just how important they were to each other. More so to the fact that where, you know, she needs him, he needs her, because she's able to keep him straight. You know, Gurren almost was able to turn him, but Konami brought him back from the brink of darkness. You know, by basically, what the hell are you doing? Get your ass in gear. She basically, get your ass in that machine, and you fight those Venoms, mister. And you do it now, or I'm going to hit you with my paper fan of doom. It was brilliant, and I loved it. And it was just a great look into sort of these two people who really love each other and how much they need each other. The evolution of it was great. The whole haircutting moment was a really, really just wonderful moment as part of the relationship. And again, those scenes to where they're realizing how much they need each other. To the fact that where Sosuke goes to a prostitute, a ghost bit of prostitute, to her room because she looks like Konami. Like, okay. And by the way, one of my favorite scenes, not the favorite scene, which I'm about to talk about, because we're going to talk more about some of the violence and we're going to talk about comedy in a second. Well, we're going to talk about, because I think I said my thing on violence, but I'll get to that in a second. But one of my personal favorite scenes is at the end, where Konami's basically trying to say, I need you, Sasuke, but she keeps hesitating. And mind you, I'm sitting here watching this like, uh-huh, yeah, no, I couldn't hear you? Yeah, what was that? Could you say that again just a tad bit louder? Because I couldn't hear you, honey. What was that? Was that you? Did you say you needed him? Of course, that's me and I playing more of the comedic aspect of it. But, yeah. But definitely that's there. I'm going to touch on violence again. Because I had the note in it. But I kind of covered it already. Just... There's just a certain scenes to where I think they take the violence a bit too far, and that kind of hurts the series for me. I made mention to the throat slitting scene, but just Gates playing with the lifeless dead body of, I believe it's, Lon. Just really, that was necessary. I mean, again, you hate. You feel so much sympathy and you feel so sad for the death of these girls who are antagonists, but it's just these girls who have been corrupted basically since they were young, and for them to have, even though they're still children, and for them to die like dogs, it's just horrible. And you feel for them, but you're watching Gates in his just absolute insanity playing with Lon and then breaking her arm, which snaps Fawn and leads to her death by Gates. It's just, I felt it was just a bit too far, and it's one of the marks for my series. It's the violence at certain places is just a bit much. I think lastly we'll talk about comedy here, because the comedy was good. I love the comedy. They did a great job of just setting up the physical comedy here, left and right. I keep mentioning my favorite scene, one of my favorite scenes of all anime, the screenshot scene that I want. It's definitely, it was episode 5, yeah. And you would think I'd be talking about Mao in the sexy evening gown outfit and that very sexy scene, because I am a fan service fan. No, though she was definitely sexy in that scene. But that whole car chase scene was just brilliant. The action, mind you, was gorgeous and wonderful. Again, that whole joke, I'm like, you know, well, this is the fastest to go. We need to go faster. We need to lighten the load. Well, maybe emptying all those guns in the back will do it. Guns? Pull down the back seat. Why didn't you tell us they were there? All right, Kurtz, let's rock and roll. And they're firing missile launchers and machine guns and everything. And it's awesome. And the culmination is at the end point where they finally eliminate the last of the Mafia. And Sosuke's on the phone with Kaname, and she's yelling up like, no, Kaname, no, I'm serious. Meanwhile, and this is why it's a green shot, Sosuke on the phone, you know, the traitor that they've, prisoner that they've captured, they keep, like, knocking him out with the butt of guns and, like, stop, you know, and, you know, hilarious. He's knocked out. Sosuke's on the phone, and Kurtz and Nalissa just have this look of glee on their face. Like, we got to shoot people today. We're very, very happy. I want that screenshot. I want that as a wallpaper, because it's absolutely hilarious to look at. That's one of my favorite scenes, because it's just so goofy and funny. And it just works so well. So the comedy in this series, you know, from Sosuke going to get a haircut and him constantly trying not to flip out and treat everything as a military situation, and able to do it all the way up to the point to where the scissors are taken out. It's like, you know it's coming. You know you want to do it. But yeah, the comedy is just really well done. The whole second episode with the radar. The poor stuff that happens to their teacher, to her computer continuously being fried, to her car being taken apart. The comedy is really well done and does a great job of lighting the series up at certain points when it needs it. So the series never feels out of place, and that's a really good thing. And lastly, the pace is just perfect. Really well done pace. Final thoughts on this series. This is a really good bookend to this franchise as far as this point, because there hasn't been any more Full Metal Panic. There's definitely more novels and more continuity that they could follow from the novels for Full Metal Panic, and I definitely would love to see more Full Metal Panic in the future. But as of this point, this is the end of that franchise, at least at this point. And it, like I said, it's a great bookend. It really explores more into Sosuke, more into the relationship of Konami and Sosuke. And does a great job of raising the bar again for both mech series and for its own franchise to accomplish. It's a solid series. It's not the best of the series. I definitely like FOMOFU and Fullmetal Panic more, but by no means is it a bad series. I think the violence is taken a bit too far at places. And anybody who's heard my opinion from watching the first episode of Attack of the Titans, you know how I feel about, like, ultra violence, which is amazing. Because one of my favorite animes is Guyver, who's supposed to be the new face of ultra violence. But Yeah, it's. I think it's taken a bit too far here in certain places. But it's not. None of those places are places to where it makes me stop watching the series. Like the end of episode one of Attack of Titans did. Not that I'm trying to pick on Attack of the Titans, which I know to a lot of anime fans right now is just absolute blasphemy. But it's a really good series. It's not as good as the others, but it's still really good. It's little things here or there that are more opinionated that I just disagree with. So at the end of the day, Full Metal Panic, the second raid, gets a 4 out of 5 from me. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember, if you have any comments, any whatsoever, and you want to contact the show to let me know what you thought of my review for this episode, for this podcast, how I'm doing, anything I can improve on, and I'm sure there's tons of stuff I can improve on. Remember, there are several ways for you to contact me. One, you can always contact me at the Absolution Network email account, which you can do by sending email to absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. That's absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. And remember, the A and the N in that email account are capitalized. Or, I don't know if it matters actually, but in the way I have the account, it is. So, I don't know. Send it. Maybe it'll come anyways. Either way. Also, you can contact the show by sending a comment to our Facebook page by going to facebook.com and searching for The Absolution Network. We are the one with the, you know, Absolution Network logo and the Toonami header. Find us on Facebook, like us, and leave us a comment there. And, of course, you can always leave a comment on the website itself that you can find at www.an.132productions.com. You can also make sure to check out all our other 132 Productions content, which, of course, includes the Otaku Momentum right here on the Absolution Network. Gene and Chris's Shaft Plus podcast that you can find at www.shaftplus.com. And of course my other podcasts, which include the Tokyo SOS A Godzilla podcast, which you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And of course my Comic Book Crazy podcasting network, which features the Comic Book Crazy and Hexcast podcast, that you can find at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And of course, while you're there, look on the sidebar and check out all our friends, which of course includes Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box, Brad Douglas's Spider-Man Crawlspace, Steven Fleischer's Major Spoilers podcast, and of course, Scott Gardner's Two True Freaks, along with many, many more on the sidebar of the site. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what I'm gonna have next week. I know one thing. I'm gonna be setting myself up for the big celebration that is the 29th. But if I'm able to watch all of what I want to watch, we're going to be diving into possibly one of my favorite animes of all time. Though it definitely, I was about to say it's not in my top 10, but thinking about it, yeah, it's definitely in my top 10 list. That's if I can finish it. If not, there'll be something else. So it's a surprise for what I'll be reviewing next week. So until next time, my anime fans, and my Toonami generation, find cover. It's gonna get the stay going.
Well, that about does her. Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom, signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.